Greetings, this is Reverend Juliet Nightingale, and welcome to this transmission of Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. This is a program centered on near-death experiences and similar experiences. I'm hearing an echo, so I hope that this isn't going to be throughout the show. But anyway, let's just ad-lib. This is a program centered on near-death, out-of-body, and similar spiritually transformative experiences and related topics, including what one should know about the dying process, the many facets of after-death communications, living interdimensionally and being multisensory, intuition and telepathy, and more. We feature special guests who are both experiencers and researchers in the realm of NDEs and related topics. You can find out a lot more about our work and the services and support that we offer through Toward the Light by visiting our website, towardthelight.org, and our media site, towardthelight.info. And this week, we were to have our wonderful friend, David Icke, on, and unfortunately, he became violently ill this morning. So we have a mutual friend of me and David's on this show today, Mr. Neil Haig. And I want to welcome you, Neil, onto the show.
Hello.
Are you there,
evening.
Neil? How are you, love?
I'm good. I'm fine. It's, I'm ashamed about David. I do hope he's okay. It's a pleasure to be here, though. You know, it's been a few months, hasn't it? And
it has been.
So pleased
to be back. And we actually had you scheduled for next week, and so it's so wonderful that you just offered to come forward and swap places. And what I'd like to do, just to take a little wee moment here, for all of us to focus on David right now and send him lots of love and healing energy, because he has been really, really struggling with his health, fluctuating up and down, and sometimes becoming pretty serious, even kind of grave. And so let's just take a wee moment here to send him lots of love and gratitude and prayers and healing energy, and just let him know we all love you, David. We're thinking about you and sending good thoughts your way. And I've also been sending Reiki to you all day, David. So rest up, lovey, and we'll get to do this show soon. Maybe next week, hopefully, if you're feeling better. So everybody keep David in your prayers, and I'm sure he will very much appreciate that. I want to share just a brief little announcement here, and this is rather exciting. Today actually marks the two-year anniversary of this radio program, Toward the Light, Leading Back to the Source. So I feel very, very honored to have the show, and goodness me, how it has grown, and I feel very, very humbled and such deep gratitude for all of you listeners, my wonderful friends, the guests who've been on my show, the guests who are forthcoming. Without all of you, this could never have been possible. And I also want to thank, of course, Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio, and Scott and Regina with the Conscious Media Network, who also simulcast Toward the Light. All of you wonderful people, and of course, your names too numerous to mention, but you know that I'm really thinking of you and sending lots of love and gratitude your way. Toward the Light debuted actually on 6 March 2006 with PMH Atwater, who's a noted researcher of NDEs and an NDEer herself. So it's really been magical and wonderful. And again, I want to extend my deepest love and gratitude to all of you. And we're going to keep going here and having a wonderful, wonderful program. And once again, Neil Haig is a brilliant, brilliant artist, author, mystic, and the author of a book, True Ancient Eyes, and his other book is Journey in the Dreamtime. So we're going to talk about how all of this is connected. Of course, Dave and I were going to talk about consciousness today, so I'm sure that Neil and I will be talking about this a lot as well. So anyway, once again, welcome back on to Toward the Light, Neil. It's so wonderful to have you with us, love.
I'd just like to say also, Juliet, that, you know, it's a pleasure to be here. And think while we're thinking of David, you know, this man has dedicated a great chunk of his life to, you know, to raising consciousness, you know, in the last 15 years. And it, you know, it's hard work. You know, it's never ending in that sense. And I've been with him, you know, as much as I can in terms of how I see the same sort of, you know, things that are going on in the world. I've been 100% behind David all the way. So I wish him well. I hope he gets better soon.
Oh, me too.
You know.
What seems so wonderful about this, too, is I've been able to validate so much of what he has said as a result of my own experiences. And he's just such a tremendous soul and just this selfless service to the whole world. And
absolutely.
So I think the least we can do is send him lots and lots of love in
absolutely.
Return for all that he's done for us. So go ahead. You had something
to say. Last time we spoke, I think we were talking about... We talked about a whole range of things, didn't we? And then we were talking about visionary art, and we were talking about shamanism, and then we got onto consciousness and other stuff, and we ran out of time, didn't we? It was so, you know, it went so quick as time does. It's such a, you know, such an illusion in that way. But, I mean, you know, whatever we can talk about in terms of whatever we can cover tonight, I'd be happy to talk about my paintings in more depth. I'd be happy to talk about a whole range of things, Juliet. You know, it's, like I say, it's such a pleasure to be here. You mentioned consciousness and, you know, lifting consciousness, and one of the things that I've always been interested in is how we can use this creativity and, more importantly, the imagination to try and do this for ourselves. You know, obviously some people take their own specialist angle on this, and whether it's art or whether it's singing, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, whether it's meditations, contemplations, whatever it is, it's for me, it's always been the one of the main ways in which we can reconnect with what we all talk about or hear about a lot, which is this idea of infinite consciousness, or this idea of elevating ourselves to another level of consciousness, something that would take us away from all the strife and the troubles in the world that seem to constantly plague this reality, at least anyway. No matter how much we, you know, we try and switch off from it, it doesn't go away on one level because we're immersed in this world. But at the same time, we do have an effect on the world by how we, you know, how we take charge of ourselves as such, if you know what I'm trying to say. So,
absolutely.
You know,
and your artwork is such a beautiful portrayal of, you know, the interdimensionality of our consciousness and our selfhood, and you've been such a wonderful complement to David's work with your art, and of course being an artist myself, I appreciate so much the work that you've done, and also how the art itself is such a wonderful meditation and helps us to really get in touch with the deeper aspects of our being and also the deeper aspects of reality. And it's something that's so interesting that, you know, I love to read a lot as well. And I've been reading a book called Dying to Live, The Near-Death Experience by Susan Blackmore. And, of course, she's a debunker, right? And I'm so blown away at people like this who are so hell-bent on wanting to deny that consciousness and selfhood live outside of the physical body, you know, and... So many of these people just want to insist that this is all just the dying brain, and I think, what's the payoff in believing that we are these finite, five-sensory beings, and that's all there is to reality? And it just has got me gobsmacked.
Well,
and yet,
It's true, Julie. I didn't mean to interrupt, but it's true, because when you look at it for what it is, I mean, it's having this idea that the physical world is the only reality that we could possibly have is as superstitious and as, you know, it's superstition in itself, but it's also a form of acceptance, and it becomes a mythology as well when you actually, you know, understand not only the science, but what, say, for example, visionary art's been trying to come to terms with for since the time of the shaman, you know, which goes way back to the prehistoric time in terms of how we've tracked linear history. But, you know, it really is about not imitating physical material objects, you know, in terms of my understanding of art, and whether it's, you know, whether it's trying to deal with reality or whether it's trying to, trying to understand how the nature of reality. It is about embracing all these other finer levels and these other infinite levels and frequencies and all these other levels of consciousness that exist just as much as, you know, the physical world exists. And once we open our minds to it and once we access our imagination in that way, then, my goodness, you know, from a creative point of view, then we're freeing ourselves from a lot of unnecessary, you know, mental chains that hold us and keep us, you know, keep us down and don't allow us to access these other worlds. And that's what I've been primarily interested in for the best part of the last, I would say the last 10 to 12 years, but probably a little bit longer. I've got more and more interested in how art and our creativity and how the imagination can free us. And what I've been doing in the last, in the last couple of weeks, I've been organizing workshops for this summer in the United Kingdom. So I don't know whether or not, but it sounds like a bit of a plug on your show, but I'm hoping to, well, they will go ahead this summer, but I'm hoping to do some of this on a more personal level with people that attend the workshop in terms of how we access our innermost being and how we apply that to our creativity. So it's not a specialist thing necessarily. We all have this ability, and as history shows us, not least when you think about, you know, art, children are the most greatest artists of all, really. You know, they are genius in their own way. So it's not that we have to be competent painters or drawers or, you know, or such. We just have to allow ourselves to kind of relax and get in touch with these other levels of ourselves. So we free our mind, if you know what I'm saying, from all the sort of intellect and analytical observation that we take on every day. It's got to counteract itself at some point, Juliet, because the way in which the world is operating, it's going to ultimately reach a point of ultimatum. This is where the robot structure and the whole idea of consciousness becoming robotic and all the things that David has talked about in his books and others like him, you know, the idea of turning us into slaves, into robots of the mind more than anything, this will only change unless we really access ourselves and our own inner power. And that comes from raising consciousness, which is something that's easier said than done, but it's something that we all have this ability to do. And, you know, it's touched upon in songs throughout the ages, hasn't it? There's been the likes of John Lennon and Bob Marley and all these other famous artists and musicians that have tried to get the same message across. And it's something that we can only take charge of, our own power, and ourselves can only deal with that. But it's something I've been passionate about anyway, hence probably my connection with David over the years. You know, it's been something that we've entwined ourselves with in terms of words and image, if you know what I'm saying. So.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful, and your points are so spot on too, because, you know, when people are doing the artwork, that it's a tremendous source of freedom of expression, and the fact that, you know, that I do music too, you know, we can sort of get away, as it were, with so much by just having this creative expression and being able to convey so many things that we otherwise wouldn't have been able to do. And it was so interesting when I was reading David's newsletter last night.
Oh, yeah.
And he was talking about the intellect, and there's a beautiful illustration on his newsletter where you see the left brain that's all full of these sort of prism robotic cubbyholes, as it were, and then the right side of the brain looks like a park, and you see the artist and the musician and the meditator and the writer and the people playing and flying kites and just being free spirits and being joyous and full of love and
absolutely
really being in touch. And this, I just thought, this is such a perfect example of, you know, of really how consciousness works. And that if, and it's interesting because he was talking about Oxford. Now didn't you say that you, did you move back to that area to work in Oxford?
Yeah, I moved up this way. I'm not quite in Oxford, but I moved up this way after living several years in Cornwall. And, yeah, it's funny that he was up there anyway, obviously talking. But the whole, it's funny actually, because the whole area, just looking at that for a second, the whole area is pretty amazing. In fact, funnily enough, just today, and I swore I wouldn't mention this to my partner, but I'm going to mention it a little bit. Is that just today I went to we visited the Hellfire caves, which are not far from Oxford and all that area, and some of them have been exposed in conspiracy books over the years as being this kind of place where you know, satanic rituals have taken place, and it's interesting looking at how energy works, because being on the mound where, just above the caves, and looking out over the landscape, there is this feeling of an immense energy that is obviously activated through in which way the land lies and all the other sort of facets to the landscape itself. And in the bosom of this hill is this horrendous energy which has been perpetrated over hundreds of years, and probably not so much in the modern age, excuse me. And basically, what dawned on me was that energy, because we are energy, in as much as, you know, we when you break it right down to its basic level, we're nothing but consciousness and energy in itself. While I was up there, I started to get this image of, as I've had before in other places, of all the ley lines and all the energy fields that fly, what would fly across the physical world, across the energy grid of the planet as such. And I felt myself, you know, sort of accessing this on a level that was beyond the intellect, which is beyond all of these sort of learned sort of centres of study, like the ICON, Oxford University, and all the other places that you get around the world. And you couldn't possibly start to explain this to anybody who's left brain structured. They have to be able to access their right brain, unbalance the two together, and at least operate from a level which is completely outside of the mind anyway, which is the heart. So you're feeling this at the heart center, and you're activating this through the imagination, and you're sensing these things, and you're seeing these things. And it's no similar to what I was saying also the other day when I was, again, in a similar area, and I had this vision of how the topography would change, and I had this image of, you know, something else going on. And it's the same happened to me when I've traveled in other parts of the world, where you get either a flash of the future or an instance of what's happened in the past, and it comes through the imagination. It comes through this ability to be able to see something which is not necessarily there in front of you. And, I mean, I could give you loads of examples of it. You know, like I say, one example would be I think I'm going to have told you this before, but when I was traveling in the Cathar country a good 10, 12 years ago, and I was on a hilltop, which was once a Cathar fortress, and I was up there, and I ended up camping up there for the night, like I say, many years ago, and it was amazing, really, because in the evening, in the early hours, you know, I was awoken in the tent to this sort of sense of the wind making, as wind does, it makes an horrendous sound, plays with the mind. It really does. It feels like spirit, you know, it feels like things are moving, and energy is out there. And what happened was that I started to hear things. So it's not just with the eyes, like I say, it's not beyond the five senses, and not just with the imagination. I started to hear sounds of what sounded like horses eating the grass, you know, and stomping around the tent. Now, this is way up above, you know, sea level. It's in the middle of nowhere in southern West France. And I can assure you, you know, there wasn't any horses around, not least where we had the tent anyway. So, you know, never thought of any the next day, and carried on with the trek, you know, hiking through the countryside, and then got to another village, and eventually found a tour guide of that particular area and of that particular castle. And lo and behold, where we put the tent for the night was the actual stables where the horses would have been kept something like 1,000 years ago. So the wind was actually, you know, the wind itself and the landscape and the topography was playing its part in this sort of wonderful sort of palette of the senses, which allows you to tap into all of these things. And that's just one incident, you know. I mean, there's so many over the years where you can, it becomes something that fuels your art and your creativity, not least, because you're constantly, you know, going into this place that fuels the imagination. The other side to it, Julia, is that you have to sometimes be still and you have to contemplate as well to be able to access these other worlds. And it's not necessarily some sort of structured meditation, but it's possibly something where you know, you just go for a lie down or daydreaming kicks in, you know, where you tend to sort of go into this. They are definitely worlds beyond this world, and the only way you can do it is by slowing yourself down to a point of stillness, which is where everything could possibly exist in that quiet moment. And I've done paintings, I've created paintings out of that kind of time frame where there is no time. I put a blank canvas on the easel and I've done what some would call meditation, but I wouldn't see it as that necessarily. But and then an image has occurred within a space of a few hours, and that image is telling me something of something that exists beyond the physical realm, you know. So it's something that the ancients have talked about. It's something that, you know, visionary artists going back to the time of when the church were within control of art, you know, I would say sort of 2,000 years. There's 2,000 years window from the time of the Roman period right through to the Renaissance period, where, you know, art was used by the church predominantly as a propaganda tool, not least people like that.
Well, that just goes to show what a powerful medium art is, you know, because and what you're describing also is what I experienced during the NDEs, because there is no time space, and from that vantage point. Because what happened to you, obviously, tapping into not only another dimension, but you did time traveling, and again, there really is no time. So when you move beyond this physical 3D, you are able to experience other dimensions and realities simultaneously.
That's right.
When you're open, that's very easy for you to do, and obviously because you are so receptive and open, it's easy for you to have these experiences, and no, they're not hallucinations. And I really wanted to point out something very important, because I admit I'm feeling really frustrated with the life of Susan Blackmore right now. The hallucination is so vastly different from these lucid experiences, because for one thing, the memory of a hallucination fades very quickly. Whereas when you have these other experiences, the memories of them don't fade. And also, even whilst you're going through the experiences, you remain very coherent, very alert. You're able to communicate simultaneously with different people. Like, for example, when people are having deathbed visions, they can turn around and carry on a conversation with you with the utmost of clarity. This cannot happen when one is having a hallucination or when one is dealing with a dying brain. I'm sorry, but that's just not the way it works. So, you know, and you weren't even ill. You weren't even having any sort of drug. You were just in this space and being open and meditative.
Absolutely.
And all of this came to you.
I'll be clear about this. I mean, it's not the fact that, you know, it's funny because over the years I've been teaching art in schools and colleges and universities, and, you know, one of the things that students say to me is, crikey, you know, how much have you taken, you know, and it's a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to something that looks obscure or looks psychedelic or whatever it is, and I can say this categorically, it doesn't interest me, never has done. You know, the whole idea of hallucinogenics and all of those things that relate to that type of mind-altering activity, I wouldn't say that it's just not for me. I wouldn't condone, you know, and I wouldn't be judgmental at all about any of that. I mean, in terms of the ancient world, it obviously was used for specific ceremonies. Tribal cultures, you know, access various natural substances to be able to go into these other realms. You know, a lot of people have talked about it over the years. What I'm interested in is something that is more pure in itself, in terms of that we become a conduit, because we're actually dealing with something that is not necessarily induced chemically through the brain. It's something that is inspired or is tapped into via our own consciousness ability. How can I put that? More of our own inner consciousness actually accesses the information that we need rather than getting a vehicle to take us there. I suppose it's a little bit like going for a walk to a place rather than relying on a car or something else to take us there, because we see, sometimes we see so much more and we experience much more when we do that. There's also other things as well which go above and beyond sometimes, you know, the manufactured side of how we're inspired. And I'm not saying for a minute that you know, that people that have had inspiration or artists, you know, writers, poets and musicians that have taken certain types of drugs haven't been truly inspired, because they have. But there's other acts of kindness and other acts of creativity that go hand in hand without any need for that type of talk, you know, or that type of sort of understanding. And one of the most lovely stories, and I don't know whether you've ever heard of this, but one of the most lovely stories I ever read was a book by a French author called John Gino, and it was called The Man Who Planted Trees. I think it was originally called something like The Man Who Planted Hope and Grew Happiness. The wonderful book, but just, I'm not going to go into great detail about it, but the whole idea of accessing your creativity and becoming a divine creator in your own right is so encapsulated in this story. It's almost a parable in its own way. And it literally is something to do with the fact that even the most simplest of us, the most humble, the most poorest, the most meek person can actually create something which would leave its mark on Earth, or, you know, or in the community, that would touch other people for years to come, which is part of the native philosophy of thinking of the seventh generation, you know, thinking of the future generations. And what this guy does in the book, this old sort of shepherd farmer character, is that basically every morning the ritual that he has, and it's an act of creativity, he plants oak trees, and he's planting these oak trees while the rest of France has been ushered into the First World War, and young men have been taken away to, you know, to serve at the front, you know, and to fight against the, you know, fight the empire as such. And he carries on in his own sweet way planting trees, and it's just the way in which the writer explains it. He says, out of the hands of this soul, without any technical resources, sprouts eventually something like 12 kilometers of oak trees, which grow and grow eventually and become vast forests, which other families and other villages, you know, they spring up in the area, and other people come, and the communities start. And this is just a simple man who looks after sheep, but at the same time he's planting trees for the love of nature and for the love of humanity. And it's these random acts of creativity and these inspired things that we do that change, in some ways, change the levels of consciousness that, you know, David banged his head against, you know, and frustrated about, and like all of us do, when we're trying to explain this idea of elevating consciousness. And I give you another example as well, which was in the newspaper in the UK only the other day. There was this young guy called Mark Boyle, a self-anointed peace trekker, as he called himself, and the newspapers had him out as being a similar thing. And he decided he was going to set off from the UK and walk 8,000 miles to India, to the place of Gandhi's birth or death, wherever it was. And he only got as far as France, apparently, according to the press, because we live in such an uninspired, unimaginative, uncaring, inhumane sort of frequency range, you know, the third world has become, you know, the third dimension has become as such. And this poor guy who was trying to make a point about humanity and humility and all the rest of it gets stopped as he gets so far and gets branded as a vagrant and a freeloader. And what I'm trying to say, I suppose, is that the only way we can actually, you know, access or change anything, especially change consciousness, is by doing what's right anyway, no matter what. And this is, you know, this is what this guy did in the story, you know, this wonderful story of the shepherd farmer, and what this poor guy did recently, who tried to sort of walk in the name, he tried to do a trek for, you know, in the name of peace and humanity. It was a charity-based walk. And all we can ever do is do what we came here to do. You know, all we can do is use the time that we've been given to be able to change our own world and change ourselves from within. And by doing that, I suppose, we automatically have to affect the outer world, because we're so connected to it anyway through our very being as such. You know, so it, it's It's something that I've always been passionate about anyway. I've always been interested in wanting to know more about that, you know, and actually tap into that. So hence the treks, hence the paintings, and all the traveling and meditating and all that sort of stuff. So, you know.
Well, that's a wonderful story, too, because I think about all of the dark and negative encroachment that's taking place right now, and it's just being so amplified on a daily basis, and it's really upsetting and frightening. But conversely, also what is happening is that the light is getting so much brighter too, and it's amazing the spontaneity, the synchronicity, and the synergy, how people are simultaneously being brought together to exact and effect a very positive change. And you know, I was thinking about this, and I even shared this with David. Is that the fact that I mean, goodness me, he's been through tremendous odds, and I have too. I've died, this body has died a number of times. I've been through unspeakable odds and trauma in my life, and yet I'm still alive. Kathy O'Brien is still alive. And I said to him, I said, is this not a profound and powerful example of how the light is getting the upper hand, has intervened, and has enabled us to survive and overcome these great odds and share a powerful message of love and truth, and that love does and will prevail in the end despite this darkness? Otherwise, why would we have been sent back? Why would we still be alive if there was nothing that we could do about this? If all of this love and the light were going to be abolished? Well, it just can't be so. Now, there is a lot of work involved, but I think that as we keep focused on the light and on the love and keeping a childlike sense of awe and wonder and openness, that is what is going to enable us to move back into the light and have that freedom that comes from the deep knowing that is stemming from the fact that we are indeed multidimensional beings, and that we are indeed always, always, always conscious. And I think that, you know, people are so afraid of death. Why? Because they think that their selfhood, their consciousness is going to be terminated. But the fact is that it is not. And as children, we are still remembering past lives. We are remembering our life on the other side, and then this comes through our art, our music, conversing with our invisible friends. So wonderful people like you are able to sort of help bring back that childlike innocence and openness.
It's true, I agree with you, Julia. I mean, it's totally what we feed, isn't it? It's what we give our attention to, where we put our attention, you know, that energy flows to that area.
Yes.
So if we become, if we remember that we are vessels of light, in as much that we, you know, we can't be destroyed. I mean, there's a great line from one of Bob Marley's songs about love never leaving you alone. And love will never leave us alone. You know, the darkness cannot exist without light anyway, in that sense. And light, you know, light creates darkness. It's part and parcel of this this idea of night and day, seeming like they're two enemies, but actually they're both in search of each other. They're both looking for that, you know, that infinite within each opposite or each part of the scale. And there's a lovely understanding of it when you, the whole idea of us being light, and the fact that we're not so much conditioned, but we've entered into a sort of how can I put this? A sort of a pact. We're in a frequency range whereby we don't necessarily express that light. Mainly through fear, obviously, fear of what others might think of it, which is something that it's quite obvious when you look at it for what it is. But what's beautiful about it is that if we express our light, then that light automatically touches others. Light begets light. Light affects other light. And there's a lovely story in one of the parables, I think, in the New Testament, to do with the fact that if the true human being, the true essence of humanity is a light, and what we do, we don't. If we were to see that as a beautiful lamp in a shop or in a department store, we wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't necessarily go out and buy this light and then take it home and wrap it in paper or put it in a box and shove it in the cellar. We'd put it in the private place in the home, switch it on, and let it beam out perpetually, and show that light to everybody that we, you know, that comes into our lives. And this is the true essence of humanity. It is divine light, and it's that divine light that has been touched upon within, you know, within the idea of visionary art and the, you know, the agnostic and the all of the, you know, other sort of cultures that have looked at shamanism and all these other areas where we're trying to express or trying to understand the human divine form. One of the greatest, thinkers in that way was William Blake. Artist, you know, the British visionary, and he said something like, he had a lovely quote, which actually relates to NDEs, actually, in many ways, and he says, "This world of imagination is the world of eternity. It is the divine bosom into which we shall go after death of the vegetated body." And he said, you know, the whole idea that the imagination is the actual true nature of humanity is the nearest thing to what, you know, what we would call religiously, you know, God or the mind of God. It is the eternal, ever-flowing river of consciousness that we tap into. And how deep and how wide and how far it is depends on our level of imagination and how we actually access that to shape our world. And some will say, well, why can't I access this imagination, and why can't I change my world in an instant? Well, there's so many different factors we could go into that impede on that, not least how we're programmed and how we're conditioned and how our DNA affects us, which is which is becoming a very fundamental subject, isn't it, now, coming to the forefront, the understanding of how DNA is affecting our life and how it creates our life. But most people don't believe in their imagination. They actually don't exist. They feel it doesn't exist. And I can say this from teaching art now for many, many years, that, you know, you can confront students, but you can talk about this, and they will tell you they have no imagination. And I say, well, of course we have imagination. You know, the children, you give a blank sheet of paper to a child, to a toddler, and my goodness, watch the imagination, you know, go free. Watch it flourish. And it's because they know no boundaries, because it has no boundaries.
Exactly. That's a very important point you're making there, Neil, because as we get older, we are so conditioned to think smaller and smaller and smaller. And I want to give you a really interesting example. I just had my birthday exactly a month ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, then you have to
and I heard a voice saying to me, "What do you want? What is your wish?" And I was hesitating, and the voice was prompting me and saying, "No, not what you think you can have, or not what you assume is might be an option or what have you, but what do you really want in your heart of hearts? What is it that you really, really want? Infinity is the limit, you know?" And it was amazing how hard it was to just blurt out what I really, really want, because I kept censoring myself or feeling like it wasn't an option, which was absurd, really. And yet I'm even sharing with people, too. We've got to, you know, when we're children and, you know, we're asked to make a wish for our birthday or whatever, you know, we make these wonderful wishes with this conviction, oh, it's going to come true. And so finally, I just said, all right, this is what I want. I want to make music with this wonderful friend. And then I just started filling out all of these wonderful things, because being creative is what brings me the greatest joy. Not just joy, but absolute bliss. And it was amazing how free and liberated I felt just as a result of putting out my real wish. And it doesn't matter if you're 66 or 32 or 6, you know, we've got the right to have the same dreams and wishes and the ability to bring them into fruition. But it's like you were saying, you know, especially adults, you know, we just start to think so small, and how ludicrous is that? And I know my daughter, bless her, she would say, "Mom, if you're struggling with something, you don't feel well, you know, draw something. Get out your colors." Because I used to paint all the time. And now, since I don't have a canvas and paints, I build websites. That's my painting right now, because I can do that. But
well,
it,
I know. I mean, I've gone into the digital. I've been, you know, dragged into the digital world as well. I mean, I was painting before the Apple Macs were invented and all that sort of thing. And I found myself, you know, getting more and more involved in that just because of the kind of effects that you can get. And hey, this is the 21st century as such, isn't it? But it's true what you say, you know, about the idea of wishes and the idea of being able to, you know, really believe in that. And the reason why, for me anyway, the reason why we have the sort of level of consciousness that pervades in the world through, you know, through this almost a lack of vision, and why we're perishing, or we're told that we're perishing anyway, at least by the you know, the vehicles that you know, not least the media and all the other institutes that pump out this same kind of, it's almost a frequency, it's a certain drumbeat, isn't it, every day. You know, is that we're perishing because of this? We're perishing because of the idea of, you know, because of the darkness in the world that more often than not, you know, is created and perpetrated for that end result. But if we have no vision, if we can't access our own imagination, how can we become the change? You know, that would be the change in the world. We
exactly.
have to tackle these problems from a different viewpoint, and you know, we can't. We can't go around trying to solve problems, from the same intellectual and analytical processes that have created them. And it's almost like trying to break free of something without really understanding that actually, if you were to switch off and become quiet for a while, actually everything starts to not exist. The prison bars don't exist. All that exists is what has always existed, which is everything. Above and beyond this, these self-imposed, you know, prisons of the mind. And I think it was Blake who said something like, I can't remember it exactly, it was something like, a man who never changes his opinions, his mind becomes like a stagnant pool and breeds reptiles of the mind, something like that. And it's exactly that. And funnily enough, you know, through what I've been doing over the years, through the sketches and inspiration I've had, I've had all sorts of weird insights into the nature of the, you know, the sort of force or the consciousness that is trying so hard to keep us in this prison, you know, this prison of the mind. And I kind of stumbled across it through looking into fishing, especially salmon fishing. And I said this in a talk recently, and it's true, you know, once you cage something, once you actually take its freedom away or its space away, take, for example, a you know, salmon fishing, then it automatically starts to attract to it other predators, other algae, other bacteria, that fester and live off the actual surface and the skin of the salmon while it's caged. And oh my goodness, if you look at that from a, you know, from a sort of a higher vantage point, and you take that analogy to be the spirit of humanity that is perpetually trying to be boxed into something or caged or you know, prison bound in that way, then look at what we're pulling to us when we actually hold our heads in our hands and we say, you know, we're prisoners of our own keeping, or that we're actually, you know, we're told we can't do this or we can't express ourselves in that way, or even just through the, let's be honest, just through the general systems that exist, through the money system and all the other political structures, we're actually inviting to us this sort of you know, this perishable lack of vision, which manifests itself as what David's been trying to expose for the last 15 years as the, you know, the Illuminati, or the, what I call the predator consciousness, or whatever you want to call it, because we're actually giving them kudos by actually staying within this prison structure. And
yes.
Once we see it for what it is on one level, but then we actually open our hearts to our own potential, then automatically we start to de-manifest the structures that are holding us in chains. And that's why, I suppose, on one level, that's why all of the stuff that is happening in the world today is now, we can see it for what it is. And it's one distraction after another now. Once you actually start to see it, I mean see it intellectually or see it from a point of just the mind, but actually see it with your heart, you start to notice that everything is just another distraction. It's just another false cold light that's been placed there to tantalize the human mind, like a moth to the light. You know, so it's something that we something like, once you actually know it and once you feel it, then once you open your eyes and your heart, then my goodness, well, you know, everything is possible, isn't it? Everything has to be possible because we're no longer prisoners of this structure. And then in terms of poverty and all the other things that we, you know, that we have to endure, well, a lot of that stuff is, again, some of it is levels of imagination because we generally don't believe that we can create a better life. But also, what I've noticed over the years, and this is slightly digressing, but it's important, is that, and it's especially in Britain, the whole financial structure in this country is based on land. And one of the weird things is that everybody wants to be a little, you know, a sort of lord and gentry of their own land through the mortgage yes. structure and through the financial system. And what we're looking at, I suppose, in many ways, is a total and utter illusion based on the fact that power has been vested in a system, a money structure, that has no, you know, it carries really no power once you actually take it back down to the level of the land and what it is. And that's why people are struggling in all over the world in terms of the, you know, financially now, because of the tightening of the grip that the structure is now being imposed on everybody. And it's a big lesson, you know, that we're going to learn in terms of understanding the illusion of the money structure and how we actually start to do something with it. And what I'm saying, I suppose, is that we have to be able to have, you know, invent our own ways of actually living and dealing with ourselves in communities. And this has to come through how we access our inspiration again. And obviously there's no quick answer to that, but we have to be able to go sit back, take a deep breath, and also just be inspired. We need to be able to, you know, to find time to switch off from the insanity of the world that is keeping us in that sort of, you know, that cage or that prison. That doesn't allow us to actually switch off and say, well, there has to be another way of living. And I get a bit frustrated sometimes with the whole money system anyway and the way in which, you know, people are enslaved, you know, to
absolutely.
But at the same time, there is a way out of it, and there has to be if we start operating on a different level. And whether it's a let system or whether it's all these other systems that have been tried out, or whether or not we just dismantle it because if the world is an illusion, or if the world is an extension of our own creative ability or our minds or our imagination, then the more we switch off from it, you know, and I don't mean in terms of causing a problem, but just actually disassociating ourselves with it, and the more we try and find our own power and our own center of being, then we start to manifest a whole different reality around us. We start to put in place, systems or realities that are based on higher levels of consciousness. If that's what our desire and intent is, if our desire is to go out and win the lottery or make lots of money to become another lord and gentry of the manor in our own sweet little way, then we're probably going to win because we're going to win the lottery because we're manifesting and magnetizing that energy, which is what that energy is about. It's not about doing something different with it and changing the whole way in which we look at the world, you know, and the way in which we actually affect fellow humanity. So it's, you know, we can talk about oneness and we can talk about, you know, all of those things, but we can only deal with it within ourselves, Julia. Do you know what I'm trying to say? It has to be something that we take on board for ourselves. So,
I've never really resonated with money and all of that stuff because money in itself, I mean, what is it? It's a number. It's just an illusion. It doesn't really mean anything. And the whole idea of ownership is an illusion. And I've always felt like, you know, people need to get together and finish. Sorry?
It's ludicrous, the whole idea of owning land and owning, yes. you know, owning material things in that way. It, on one level, it serves the system, which is what it's intended to do. But on another
exactly.
level, it's something that, you know, it's the whole idea of what you know, supposedly what Christ has said is store up the riches in heaven and rather than store up riches on earth because they only gather dust, you know, and thieves will come and take them. And you can't get any better thieves than the whole monetary system in itself, you know. So, of course, it's not what we're here for. It's not what our true purpose is. It's not what the real human divine form is here to do, to store up riches. It's here to create heaven on earth.
And I think that's such a valid point, too, because, you know, if one biblical statement that I think is really powerful and accurate, even though most of it's written in code, is unless you become like little children, right?
Absolutely.
You can't have the kingdom of heaven. And I think that the work that you're doing, again, with promoting the art and how through the creative process we can tap in to a higher consciousness, we can tap into other dimensions. And in fact, I have a lot of psychic visions when I'm doing something creative, whether I'm drawing or painting something, working on a website, playing music or singing, it doesn't matter. Somehow, I just feel more full and more in touch with what is truly real and very open, and it's amazing how I just become flooded with visions and ideas, and I will actually hear people telepathically talking to me whilst I'm in a creative project of some sort. So, again, I think that it is so paramount what you're doing in you know, teaching the art and sharing the example of how these creative forms actually enable us to expand out and away from the mind prisons that we've been subjected to. Something kind of funny and ironic I wanted to share is that there was a man who's a conservative Christian, and yet he's got a big heart, a really wonderful person, but you know, the way he believes is a little bit scary to me. But anyway, he said, and he said this about them, you know, he said, us conservatives want to get it right the first time because we are not willing to change our minds.
Absolutely, that's exactly that's a perfect analogy of the structures that hold us in mental slavery and also hold us down. And it's funny because I always keep coming back to William Blake all the time, because for me, you know, it's always been an inspiration to to look at his work anyway from an artistic point of view. But also some of the, you know, some of the concepts and philosophies of the great visionaries that, you know, spoke about some of the truths we're talking about. But you know, one of the lovely quotes from Blake was a little poem, something that went along the lines of, "For mercy has a human heart, pity a human face, and love the human form divine, and peace the human dress." And what he was saying, and what I'm trying to, you know, come to terms with, and what I'm expressing here, is that at the deepest core, right at the center of what we are, is not what we've been told we are. You know, we're conditioned to see ourselves so differently to what we actually are, what we're capable of. And that lovely quote you were talking about, you know, the child within, you know, the idea that unless you change yourself and you become like little children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven, or something like that. And you have to humble yourself as a child again. You have to humble yourself as if you are childlike in terms of purity and spirit. And, you know, this is one of the greatest gifts. This is one of the this is the symbol of the child holding the staff of wisdom, you know, the old sort of archetype that you see sometimes etched into alchemical illustrations and other things. It's the old man who's also a child, you know, or the woman that is holding a child to her bosom. You know, the idea of joy and divinity and the you know, the humbleness of humanity. And this is something that you can't teach this. This is something that you can't explain. This has to be felt, and it has to be felt at such a level. It's when you stand before nature, or you stand before something marvelous, like you know, watching two people embrace, or you're looking to somebody's eyes, or you know, it's captured beautifully by some of those artists. I mean, the one I'm thinking of was Cecil Collins in the UK, who died in the late 80s. A wonderful visionary artist, in my view. And he said something like, if, you know, a bird singing in a tree, that how can you tell the difference between the song of the bird and the branches that it's sitting in? And it's this wonderful idea that, you know, something has to move you, and something has to be able to has to touch your heart to a point where you can then you know, you can actually access that energy within yourself and then give that outwards to other people. You can't get that without feeling it yourself. You know, you have to be able to go and experience it. So through our art and through our creativity and through our imagination is one of the ways in which we can get in touch with that. And, you know, I'd be a fool not to say that there isn't other ways, but that's my way. You know, that's something that I've been interested in. And obviously yourself, Juliet, you know, you talk about art in such a way, and it's something that is overlooked massively, isn't it, in the art schools and in the academies.
Oh, dear,
it's something that you don't want to acknowledge, you know, the fact that there is a deeper reason for art. I mean, as soon as you start talking about it, one of the things that comes up all the time is art therapy. You know, it's almost as though... You know, that's vital as well, and that's an important part of what we're talking about. But there are other areas, and as I said in Journeys in Dreamtime, it starts to expose another history of art. It starts to look at something that is not only giving you the keys to unlock your own imagination, your own creative ability, but it's giving you a different view of the world, and everybody's view and everybody's perception is different. And that's one of the things we don't celebrate, is it? This diversity. We're constantly told we have to judge others because of the way in which because of their difference. And it's not to do with people expressing themselves necessarily and letting them get away with atrocities. It's about celebrating the diversity, which, funnily enough, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. It's one of the reasons why the historical part of France, you know, the southwest of France, the Cathars, the Languedoc-Roussillon,
yes.
It's one of the reasons why that became such a powerful, energetic place in terms of consciousness, because it started to celebrate diversity and uniqueness on a par with what we would call the New Age today. And the New Age in some ways has got lots of distractions and other things, but it's something that the sort of controlling father figure of the church at that time, you know, the Church of Babylon and Rome as such, it basically set its sights on that area of France because of its diversity, because of what people were celebrating. And now, as David has been saying in many of his books and others like him, you know, this mentality is global. It's not about one region anymore. It's not even about Nazi Germany or about something to do with, some sort of disagreement on a national level. It's actually global. It's a global state of affairs now where freedom of expression is almost becoming, an offence because of this. And as artists and as writers and as poets and creative people and as souls, you know, incarnate on this planet, we have to come to a point where we say to ourselves, we're going to be who we were intended to be, who we were, you know, who we really are deep within ourselves. You know, we have to light up that lamp now, because if we don't, then what we're doing is allowing the darkness unnecessarily to take a hold. And it doesn't have to be that way, does it? You know,
That's exactly what I think. And in fact, several times I would just say, you are not going to be the ones to take me out this time. And David has pointed out so many times that we do not have to allow the darkness to encroach on us and imprison us. And yes, it's very sad and frightening how in all kinds of so-called educational institutions they've been doing away with the arts and even starting to indoctrinate little toddlers in all this left brain stuff. And again, I was thinking about the fact that he was at Oxford and giving a lecture there. And you know, it's funny with me trying to converse with all of these academics. I mean, they can't think for themselves. They're so locked in this formula that, you know, if you say or do anything that is outside of their formula, they just don't get it. They look at you cross-eyed.
Absolutely.
They're totally confused.
The other side of this, I've worked in education for the best part of, 10 years as well, and I've been teaching in colleges, like I say, but there's a lot of beautiful people within education. There's a lot of really dedicated people that are interested in all the things that, you know, not all of the things, but some of the things we're talking about. And what always surprises me is that what you've just described, where the shutters come down. And I was talking to David or somebody about it. I was saying, you know, funnily enough, in the UK, the A-level structure and the timetable, guess what his name is? It's called The Matrix. And
yeah.
It's so funny because, you know, you couldn't really describe it any better, really, could you? You know, and there's a great American teacher, actually, who's hardly known about in the UK. Maybe your listeners in the States would know about him. A guy called John Taylor Gatto, who was a prestigious teacher, won awards for, you know, for teaching, of a career that went over 30-odd years. And he gave a devastating speech to the mayor and the authorities and the education establishment in New York, I think, about 15 years ago, I think it was. And I was reading some of these papers, And he basically summed it up for what he was. You know, it was about indoctrination, it's about schooling, it's not about nurturing creativity. And he was a real, you know, it was a real sort of, what's the word? He was really interested in homeschooling. And he was interested in, you know, in other things as well that allowed children to access their own abilities and their own power and their own creative power, not least, to be able to make decisions rather than being told what to think continuously. And, I mean, he made some great observations, you know, about school and about the idea of bells going, and then, you know, the idea of a child being creative for an hour in, say, an art lesson, and then a bell going and having to move to another cell. And then do maths, and then after an hour move somewhere else and do another subject. No wonder these poor kids couldn't sit and actually contemplate for any longer than a certain amount of time, and why they couldn't read or even take on board these deeper understandings that relate to their own daydreaming abilities and their own creativity, you know. It's because we were nurturing very erratic, almost sort of, not intolerant, but with this inability to actually sit and nurture and contemplate these wonderful things. And school is very damaging in some ways. It doesn't suit everybody, but we all have to go by law, which says it all, really, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Really,
and
good.
Also, there's no flow in that kind of structure, and things really need to flow. And what's interesting about the near-death experience, too, and again, we're talking about consciousness, really tapping into the, you know, the truth that we are infinite consciousness, just like David points out. But what's so interesting is that so many people come back from a near-death state. A very brilliant musician, and they've never done music before, or they're suddenly able to paint and draw or write beautiful writings. They just become so expansive and creative as a result of having been to the other side, and also very psychic, very playful, very ageless. You know, people look at me and they can't tell that I'm in mid-60s, and in a sort of way I can't either, really, because, you know, what is that compared to infinity? It's just really a number, and I've never identified with chronology or time anywhere. I just don't have a sense of time. So, you know, I can feel very playful and childlike, and the Moody Blues and their music so much, they are talking about the wisdom of children. And I think, again, it's because they don't know how to not be creative and spontaneous and imaginative. And I, you know, at least with the near-death experience, those of us in our school of thought were really encouraged to use our imagination and to just allow our minds to expand. And, of course, the near-death state rather imposes that. I mean, there you are. You're outside of the physical body, and everything is very, very expansive and magnificent. So I'm really grateful for the I like to believe that this is proof that we are very expansive conscious beings, way beyond the confines of our physical bodies.
Of course it is. Of course it is. It has to be, doesn't it? I mean,
and that's what I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously something I've never experienced, but it has to be when you look at it for what it is, and you feel that, you know, there has to be this. If we're talking about infinite consciousness, and we're feeling that, and we're expressing ourselves above and beyond the parameters of the physical world, then you know, some of us will have come back. Some of them have experienced it, and they can, you know, some of the greatest seers have died, haven't they, and come back. I mean,
yes.
There is some of the I'm thinking of some of the Native American cultures now, but wasn't it Wotan or somebody? There was somebody in the a part of the Sioux tribe, the Lakota Sioux tribe, that came back came back from death and became a sort of shamanic seer, and it instigated the ghost dance, I think it was, somebody like that. But another act of creativity, another energy impression on this reality as such, you know. So it's so important. I mean, you know, what you've described is something I've never experienced, but I totally feel it, and I totally understand what you're talking about.
Well, you know what? I actually think you probably have, Neil, and the good news is that you do not have to experience bodily death in order to have such a state. And just the fact, for example, when you were in that campground, you know, and having that experience, you know, these things are very, very close. And you don't want to sell yourself short here because, you know, again, you don't have to physically die in order to have these experiences of expanded consciousness and deep knowing and really tapping into your true identity. You know, some people like me do die, but then there are other experiences that happen simultaneously. We refer to them as spiritually transformative experiences or illumination experiences or what have you. So you could be at your easel working on a painting and then all of a sudden you are transported, and that is just as valid as having a near-death experience. So don't ever sell yourself short.
I understand what you mean by that. Absolutely. Yeah, that is true, because I have experienced similar things to that. But, you know, you go to places which are beyond time and space. You go into this,
oh, absolutely. This wonderful, and your art really reveals that. I mean, goodness me, your vision is amazing. I am just so in awe of your wonderful, wonderful art. Why don't we give our listeners your website? Well, that's your name, correct? Neil Haig?
Yeah, that's right. It's just neilhaig.com. Yeah, that's it. And it's actually going to go through some changes in the next few months. It's going to be, just uploaded and changed slightly. There's things going on there. And obviously the workshops I was talking about, they're going to be featured on there. But if anybody is interested, then they can always email me via the website anyway. So, like I said, things keep moving, don't they? Things keep changing, and
absolutely. Well, I just did the same.
Flow of energy.
I just did the same to my website. I completely redid my website. All, you know, myself. I do my own websites, and towardthelight.org is 120 odd pages, and I was just like a crazy mad woman, obsessively worked on it for 10 days, and I got it up so everybody can behold a brand new revised website, and I'm very pleased with it, and making lots of changes, including the directory, which I wanted to let everybody know about, and this might interest you too, Neil. Because, actually, again, another thing that NDE ears do, they come back and they become music therapists, art therapists, teachers, counselors, what have you. So I have recently implemented the Toward the Light directory, and this is a directory where for just a little tiny yearly subscription, it's £7.50 in the UK, $15 American and Canadian dollars, or €10 per year to be listed in the Toward the Light directory, so you can list your information, your contact information, your websites, your specialty experiences, you know, if that spiritually transformative experiences, near-death experience, out-of-body experience, after-death communications, deathbed visions, any of these kinds of related experiences. Or if you're a researcher or someone who's just interested in being of support, you're more than welcome to subscribe, become part of the directory, and then you can also access the directory. And of course, it will grow in time. It's just a baby right now because
I
designed
it. Sounds like a useful tool, that does. Yeah.
I think it would be, because I want to provide a way for people to be able to connect with one another, access one another really, really easily, and then somebody could say, oh, Neil, I'd love to feature you and your art, or have you come and lecture, or something like that, you know, because, again, there's so much healing involved with all of this, and I really want to open the portals for people to be able to connect with one another. So that's a little bit of the new and the good news with towardthelight.org, and definitely feel free to share more of some of the things coming up for you. Do you have any special lectures or engagements that you've got coming up that you'd like to share? Because, again,
we've got listeners all over the world. I'm giving a talk at the end of March up in Blackpool in the UK, which is obviously a long way for you US listeners to come to. But it's
that's my birthplace.
Is that where you're from? Oh,
yeah.
Well, there you go. I'll be thinking of you while I'm up there talking at the
UFO. And Magic Deleuze is
going to
be there, too. Yeah, Magic Deleuze. He's going to be there as well? Matthew Deluge is going to be there.
Oh, Matthew, of course. I don't know Matthew. I've read things that he's written, but it's, it's the only, it's the last kind of, the last decent UK, you know, conference of that kind, really. So, it'd be a pleasure for me to go back. I haven't been there for a couple of years. So, I will say hello to Blackpool for you.
What's the date again of that? I don't remember.
It's the 29th of March. It's the weekend of the 29th of March.
All right. Yes.
So, you know, that should be fun anyway. But it's true what you say. I mean, there's a great quote from Blake, and I've said it, I've used it in the book, and I've thought that, you know, he said, "I rest not from the great task to open the immortal eyes of man inwards." And that's how I see my own artwork in that sense. That's the reason for the painting, is to keep that connection, keep that light, you know, burning, and that avenue to seeing other dimensions and other levels of consciousness. Because after all, you know, we're here for more than what we think we are, and there's always more to understand in that way. So that's something I'll always be doing. I'm going to keep that light burning as long as I can in terms of the artwork. So, you know, it's and we all have to. We all have to be able to do what's right. So it should be a time for celebration, the time that we're living in. And if you listen to the news long enough, you think it'd be a time to slit your wrists. But actually, there's much more going on unseen levels than is never going to be talked about on the media, that's for sure. So...
you're so right about that. Well, actually, I've been saying that quite a bit myself because, interestingly, I'm feeling very, very optimistic and upbeat. And you know, it's so strange because I'm dealing with a rather serious, rather grave health issue right now. And, you know, being in America, there's nothing I can do about it in conventional terms. And so all I can do is count on the love and prayers coming towards me to help me. And yet at the same time, with the optimism and the enthusiasm that I'm feeling right now, you wouldn't think that I'm getting ready to put my clogs or anything like that. Mm. I feel really rough and ready to do a lot of tremendous things, and I'm excited about this radio show. I'm excited about all of the wonderful work that we're doing, the writing that I'm doing, doing music, looking forward to doing music, getting into publishing. I mean, there's so many great potentials and things that are coming my way, and I thought, well, this doesn't look like I'm going to be popping the clogs, even though it feels like I could be, you know. But I'm very excited.
There's a lot of those feelings around, I mean, you know, it's something that, I mean, whether it's that or it's other states of being that is, you know, the states of mind that create that, but it's true, you've got to keep that light burning brightly in that way, and until it is time to not fear what the subject of death, which a lot of people do, I suppose, because of the nature of the unknown, but it, in that sense, there isn't, if you understand and take on board all of the other things that we know, and connect ourselves to it, you know, to the infinite consciousness, then the veil of tears or the idea of death is something that shouldn't be something to be frightened of, but something to embrace on one level, because, you know, after all, the imagination lives forever, doesn't it?
It really, really does, and, you know, that's why literally millions of us have been sent back to share the news, and I was told especially that I had to come back to this plane to share the truth that life is indeed eternal. We do not die. And I'm so grateful for David's article entitled Fearing for a Lifetime What Doesn't Exist. Mm. That's why I do this radio show. That's why I have the organization Toward the Light, because this is the work to let people know it's all right, friends. There is no death. You're going to realize that once you lay your body down, which is just an earth suit, it's just a garment. It's not you. It's not who you are. It's not what you're about. It's just a garment that you don in order to traverse through this dimension, just like a cosmonaut or astronaut has got to wear a certain suit in order to travel in another realm where the environment will not accommodate the physical body as it is. So these bodies are just to accommodate being in this environment, but it is not who we are. And, you know, I really feel that we have got so much now to back up this truth. That it just makes me roll over laughing when I hear people say, oh, that's just a dying brain. Well, it can't be. Because, number one, the brain is not the broadcaster. It is just the receiver. Like your radio television is the receiver. The broadcast doesn't come from your telly. It's coming from somewhere else and being filtered and decoded through the television so that you can see an image. And I really love how so many people independently have come to this same analogy. David has, I have, Dr. Penn Vandal Mill has, Dr. Peter Finnick, and Dr. Peter Finnick is a physician in England. He's in London. Penn Vandal Mill is in the Netherlands. PMH Atwater. And this is so fun, and talk about the collective consciousness that we've all tapped into this universal truth. And again, independently of one another, being able to share this. Well, if it weren't real, then how is it that we can share this? And it just resonates. Such
true
love.
Mm. Totally, Julia. I mean, what you say is very true. I do really feel that these other levels they're also projections of our true divine form. You know, they're not something that are outside of us or separate from us. We are, you know, in that sense, coming home. It is more about coming back to the heart itself. And, you know, not, you talk about organs like the brain and other things that are, you know, receivers and transmitters, and there's always, I mean, I've looked a little bit at the science understanding behind the DNA, and that being the same sort of thing. The crystalline, funny enough, the crystalline codes of the exact quality of the DNA being crystalline in itself, and to its core, the idea that this receives and transmits. In that sense, you can understand why we have some of these most amazing physical and different varieties of forms on this wonderful Earth frequency, as we call it, purely because the as we respond in terms of how we fluctuate in our own divinity, in our own power of the imagination, then we have this ability to change life forms on the Earth plane itself, because we are doing what, say, for example, the Native Americans would do when they summoned a rain dance, or they, you know, they affected the element in some way, and on one level, how even certain cultures became so immersed in their reverence of animals that they became, you know, almost kind of taking on the spirit of the animal in some ways. And whether it's from, in some cases it was malevolent, in other ways it was benevolent. But, you know, on that level, everything is actually so connected through energy that there isn't anything to fear in that sense. There isn't anything that would harm us, in as much that we have to understand that everything around us and everything that we could possibly be exists all on the same, as part of the same great universal heart or the universal mind. You know, it's all part of the same whole. So, you know, what we see is something that is separate from us. In truth, it's just like looking at a broken mirror, isn't it? It's like looking at something that is how can I put it? Something that is a total illusion in that sense. You know, everything is connected. So
absolutely,
you know, energy that lives in the afterworld, as we would call it, or entities that dwell on other dimensions. At the end of the day, as such, there is such a thing as a day. At the end of this all, how we look at this and how we perceive it is purely on our own belief ability and our own levels of understanding and imagination. Some people see the same thing completely differently, don't they?
It's so true.
Personally, don't have any fear of that, you know, of death or those or the other levels of reality in that sense, because they are part of me now as we speak. They are part of the world around us. That we're we're never separate from this. We've conditioned ourselves to believe that we're separate from everything, not least through, you know, through all the things that have been discussed on this program before, and through, you know, through other books and other researchers, not least David's work. But, you know, how could anything ever be separate from us? If we are true divine form in its entirety. I'll give you a lovely example. When I painted, in fact, this relates to David's work. Many years ago, I painted a book cover of his, a book called And the Truth Shall Set You Free.
Yes.
Yeah. You remember? Now, do you remember the painting? For people that are listening, obviously, they'll have to look at the website, they'll have to try and get the painting somehow. You have this figure standing on the earth in a kind of an expression of joy with his, not he or she, an androgynous figure with the arms outspread, radiating from the heart, the aura and the energy around this sort of almost mystical figure standing on the earth. And there's two little things about this story. I was coming off an exhibition in London years ago. After painting it in the exhibition, I was working on it, and it was in Clapham or somewhere, where I had this small show of visionary paintings, and this was one of the ones I was working on. And I was meeting some friends in the pub, as you do in Britain, go down the pub.
Yeah.
And I went in the pub, and carrying under my arm this painting, and on the paint and the easel and other things. And I plonked the painting down at the table where some of my friends were sitting, and this girl who was sitting with sitting with some friends, turned and said, she looked at the painting, and the first thing she said, and bear this in mind, it's a complete stranger, she said, "Is that a painting of God?"
Wow.
And I said, and I looked at her and I said, "That's interesting." What I was trying to capture in this image was the essence of the true human divine form, the essence of what we try and understand as God, but would be something that is within every living soul, every living being. And this image as an archetypal piece, funnily enough, was inspired by, on one level, was inspired by one of William Blake's work, which was The Dance of Albion, I think it's called Glad Day or Albion Rose. He called it several names. And on a little side note, funnily enough, the image came from an idea I had while I was once taking a bath, as you do. And I was inspired, taking a very herbal bath, but this is where the idea came from. And I was gobsmacked, actually, because I was reading a book then, not long after, a book by, I think it's Peter Arkwright, it's called Blake, it's a biography. And in there was a description of a sketchbook piece that William Blake never really painted, never finished it, it was just a small drawing. And it was to accompany the Glad Day, the Albion Rose image that everybody knows about. You look on the web, and it was a little pencil sketch of an androgynous figure or kind of a male figure of some kind standing on the earth with his arms spread out. And I thought, wow, what an interesting connection, because it was almost as though I'd tapped into this collective consciousness.
There you go.
Tap into. To pull this image in, you know. And then for some stranger in the pub to say, "Is that an image of God?" I thought, well, I ain't religious, and I'm certainly not interested in all of that, you know, any of that religious stuff. I mean, the nearest thing I would be interested in is the simple understandings and philosophies of the one that he called Jesus, whether he exists or not, is up for grabs. It's for anybody's, personal choice. But I'd be more inclined in fact, the truth is, if everybody was to try and live like the so-called philosophical teachings of the one that they call Jesus, then wouldn't we have a more wonderful world?
Isn't that the truth? Oh, boy.
For all those Christians out there that might well be listening, well, it's time to hold on to your hat, because I think really, honestly, if the one they call Jesus was to come back, I mean, it'd be, it wouldn't be shock and awe, it'd be shock and horror, really, wouldn't it, in that sense, because there's nothing about Christianity, really, that is anything to do with the simplistic philosophy of humility and peace and mercy and love and understanding and all these things that we are at our very core, and how we need to express those in the world around us. You know, we're too interested in mortgage rates and whether or not the neighbours, giving us, are we getting the best deal on something, or, what somebody else is gossiping about down the church. The whole thing has gone out the window. So, I always laugh at the idea of, and all the other religions are the same anyway, in my view, but, I always laugh at that. When we lose that essence, that pure divine understanding within ourselves, then we we make a mockery of ourselves, and we make a mockery of this idea of what we really are, which is infinite consciousness. So that woman, that girl in the pub, you know, that she saw that instantly in the image, and I that was a lovely feeling, you know, a lovely sensation for a fellow human being to recognise something that I was trying to put into it. And then obviously the book cover, you know, and the image went on to David's work, which is a fantastic book anyway, you know, and off you go. The rest is history, as they say. So.
Oh, it's splendid. I mean, I was noting your artwork as I was reading those books, and I just thought, oh my goodness, this is tremendous. It's so limitless, and it always conveyed such a very. I could feel the love in the artwork. I really could, and I get a lot when I'm looking at images and also listening to music, of course, as well. And I just thought that this is just such tremendous, inspired work. And in fact, I've put a number of your paintings on your page on my website, and that's towardthelight.org/neilhaig.html. And I really, really love your work. You've done such tremendous work, and it really conveys a lot. Just when people look at your work, I think they're going to be comforted. I think they're going to be inspired. I think they're going to be imbued with a great amount of wisdom. And it's just really incredible, the work that you are doing.
Well, there's that old saying, isn't there, Juliet? The old, I don't know whether it's a biblical saying, I can't remember whether it was the words of Christ or what. It was judge them by their work.
Yes.
You know, and not, you know, not by what they say, you judge them by what they do. And, you know, you look around you in the world, and you can, that's quite easy to understand, isn't it, really?
You know, an interesting example I've been getting lately, and of course, I first built my website 10 years ago, something like that, and then, I just recently redid the whole thing. But no matter what's really interesting is, and especially lately, I've been having this influx of people coming to me and wanting to get a reading or a healing session or what have you. And it's because when they land on my site, straight away, they're imbued with such a positive, loving feeling. They feel the love emanating from the site. And I just, the art has worked. You know, the creative work that I've put into the site and the love that I've put into the site, and again, that's another form of art, it's reaching people, it's touching people, they're feeling it. And I can't tell you the gratitude that I feel for that, because I really want to convey love to people. And, you know, people can find me so quickly. I mean, it's amazing how somebody just does a search of Juliet Nightingale or Toward the Light, and boom, you know, there's the site. And straight away, they've got a good feeling. And that's,
well, you do a great job. It does evolve that. It really does, you know. It comes from the heart, doesn't it? You know,
Yes, it does. Absolutely, it does.
It comes from your intent and what you are at your core. You know, it's at our core, like I say, I've been saying it all night, you know, it's the difference between living in the dream world and pandering to all the rules and regulations and all the other belief systems that are imposed upon us, and we impose on each other, not least our children and so on, and actually all of a sudden taking that switch off and centering ourselves and really going back to that inner core, that divine consciousness, and actually realizing that all of those other things are absolutely irrelevant to what
Yes.
we really are at our innermost being. And if we were all to, if you imagine, a billion lights switching on at one time, you know, lighting up the world in such a way, then, well, the so-called symbolism of darkness, or the darkness that is, you know, it's wonderful, isn't it, in some ways, because this idea of darkness is and good against evil is out there all the time in the movies and, you know, on the news and so on. But if we were to put out our lights in that sense, then we automatically dissipate darkness, because we are, where light exists, darkness has to be complementary. You can't have dark in the same space as light, just as you can't have live in the same space as fear.
Exactly, because they're completely different frequencies. Yeah.
Right. And when I went into the, and just to bring that back to what I said to you earlier, for people that were listening earlier, when I ventured into those caves today, the famous Hellfire Caves up in Oxford, I went for my son's Mother's Day, and I'm out looking in the Hellfire Cave. What does that say? Terrible, isn't it? But anyway, I was out there, you know, going out there having, I really wanted to go to that place. All these years I've been reading about it, and it's a terrible place. I mean, it really is, you know, I mean, the darkness, like a lot of these Masonic structures and a lot of the temples, and not least the pyramids, actually, which I was in a couple of years ago, you know, all of these places are built in such a way where there are no windows, the darkness prevails, the light is kept out, and it's done for a specific reason. The reason is so that the vibration of fear and of these realms that interlock with this resonance of dark and foreboding and whatever you want to call it, you know, one level is deeply satanic, whatever that is, where that exists, light cannot exist. Therefore, you know, and it's that wonderful analogy. I think it was Plato, you know, the Plato's cave, of the idea of the man shackled. He used this analogy to explain where consciousness came from, or where the divine consciousness came from, and our levels of perception. He said there was a man shackled in a cave, facing the wall, and all his life, all he could see were shadows dancing on the wall in front of him that took the form of people and objects. And the shadows were created by a fire that was positioned burning brightly, a man-made fire, just behind the man that was shackled facing the wall. And that's all he knew. The sounds and the noises that came from behind the fire were presented with the images of the shadows in front of him moving along the cave wall. But if this man, as Plato says, was to release himself from the shackles, or to get free and turn and face the fire, then he would be in awe of what he sees, which would be the fire and the actual reality of the people that were moving amongst that area where the fire was, you know, the actual originators of the shadows. But then if he went a stage further and he pulled himself out of the darkness and out of the cave and beyond the man-made fire, and he entered into the wonder of the true light cast by, you know, by the world outside, then he would be even more in awe of what's awaiting him, and then the world beyond that. And it's this narrow understanding of life, you know, this understanding of the focus on the shadow world in all these forms, whether it's the news, the politics, the media, all these things are all expressions of the shadow world. And
exactly.
To release those chains and turn back round and face the light, face the fire, and move beyond it, and move out of it, and out into the into this infinite sea of light which exists all around us.
And that's a wonderful illustration too, Neil, because it really is a decision that all of us make. And you know, I hear so many people saying, "Oh, but what if?" And I don't know what I'm going to do. And you know, I just have to encourage them. Well, it's important to be open, and it's important to look on the bright side and to focus on what you want and what's going to bring you joy. And again, it's interesting how I was reminded to make the birthday wish, but not just on my birthday. That's just an exercise to get us to do this each and every day, to focus on what we really want and to focus on what is positive and bright. But we need to be willing to change our minds, to not be locked in one mindset, like the conservative was talking about,
absolutely.
I hope I get it right this time.
Or the conspiracy angle of this, which is valid, but, you know, and I've seen a lot of it over the years, and I looked at websites and stuff, but, you know, the whole idea, the problem with staying in the five-sense conspiracy is the fact that you're resonating to an energy that has created the conspiracy in the first place.
Exactly.
So you become a conduit for what you... We are what we consume. You know, in other words, we become what we feed on, and in some ways that can make us ill. But in another way, we have to understand that is there, and we have to move beyond it. And that's why I say the analogy of Plato's cave is quite a lovely one, because it does take us beyond the other levels of all the frequency ranges, and we have to go back to the light. We have to go back home to what we, you know, to where we're from originally, and we can only do that for ourselves. People can show us the way. You know, great, you know, great friend of mine, you know, David, and other people can show us the way. But we have to go ourselves. We have to want to turn around and release the shackles. And the more people do it, the better it is. And the other side of this is, and I was saying this to David or to other friends, is that, you know, the control in the world that has been exposed for what it is. Well, actually, it's only a manifestation of the amount of control we have over other people in our lives. It's a manifestation of how much we control our partner, our lover, our family, our children, our neighbour. That control is then magnified to the level of control we have on a global level. If we cease to control others and we stop to have all of the thoughts that lead us down the road towards fear and guilt and anxiety and all of those expressions of the shadow world, then we start to demanifest them on the global level, because we are the world in itself.
You are so right about that.
Many years ago, I painted an image of a snapshot of people around the earth with their hands, you know, held like a sort of paper chain around the earth. And when
I've got that on my website. That's one of your paintings. I put that painting on your paint on my website.
Oh,
it's so wonderful.
I called it Free Spirits, but
yes,
the idea. That's the one. Well, the idea is that, you know, we are the world, and it's a lovely understanding in that sense, but it's true, because when you look at it scientifically, we must be. If we are all energy, then we're everything that exists. So if we then start to control another version of that energy, then we're, you know, my goodness, and if we're conditioned to believe a certain rules that allow us to do all of this in terms of control through whatever it's through, however it's expressed, or we commit atrocity, or we commit crimes against fellow humans, then, you know, on the smallest scale, it also becomes, it, in terms of the law of magnetics and the law of physics, it becomes something that is also available on a global level. So, you know, it's now, I think now more than anything, it's now time to act on that. It's now time to put into practice some of the ancient teachings that are based on the, you know, on some of the, you know, whether it's been captured in songs like, you know, like the likes of Lennon and Bob Marley, or even the greatest teachings, you know, the teachings of Buddha or Christ or whatever you want to call them, these are here for a reason. They're here to teach us how to live our lives. Not for one minute that I'm actually proposing that everybody becomes, Christian or follows a religion, because that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something that is personal to us and actually allows us to express our true divine form with respect, obviously, for other living beings.
Well, also getting back to the Native American wisdom, there's been a wonderful story where a grandfather is talking to a young lad about two wolves. And one wolf is love and the other wolf is fear, and they're in conflict with each other, and then the little lad says, which one will win? And then the grandfather says, whichever one I feed.
That's right. Wherever we put the energy to, the attention, wherever our attention goes, our energy flows. So if we're, absolutely, if we're focusing on all of those shadow objects, as I call them, the irrelevances, whether it's, you know, it's going to be something that makes us guilty or something that makes us fearful, or whether we're focusing on, the struggle or the toil, which is there for many of us, and it's something that is, you know, it's something that can only change when consciousness changes. But I mean, like I said earlier, you know, the ridiculousness of one man who sets off to walk in the name of peace, and he confronts a barrier, because the barrier is there collectively at this moment in time. Once
yes,
we accept the fact that people can express themselves in that way, then we're starting to live in a way that would be humane and would allow people to have those values in everyday life. In many ways, we hold our heads down and we don't turn on that light I was talking about before. We walk through the streets, or we go to do our jobs or whatever we do, and most of the time we're not expressing our uniqueness. We're not expressing who we really are because we're frightened of what other people might think of us. So it's something that, you know, some of the great artists and writers and some of the, you know, the ones we look back at in terms of history, they've not had a problem with doing that. That's why they become great artists and writers. And what we want, as Cecil Collins said, or was it Eric Gill, one of the famous artists, he said, we don't want a few people becoming great. or showing their uniqueness. We want everybody to be like that. The whole world needs to show its uniqueness, from child through to, you know, through to the age. At this moment
well,
in time,
that's what I was thinking about, as well as, you know, again, the fact of, you know, continually, every day, making a wish, thinking about what we really want, again, what we want, not what we're trying to avoid, and then allowing ourselves to be creative. Because this will help to break us away from the bondage of the head-down fear syndrome, you know, oh my God kind of thing. No, we've got to just, you know, create with wild abandon and be focusing on what brings us joy, because that is what is going to melt away this darkness and turn everything all around. And
that's right. If there were two dials on this world in terms of duality, you know, we've got everything, haven't we, in terms of duality? We've got night and day and up and down and hot and cold and all these, you know, all these extremes. If there was two dials, we need to be able to now balance out the darkness in that sense. So we need to be able to turn up the joy knob.
Yes.
Such, you know, we do on one level, but at the same time, you know, you can't stick your head in the sand and obviously avoid but you know, being different to what else is going on in the world around you. But at the same time, it's balancing, and it's operating on a level where you acknowledge what's going on, you can deal with it, you do what you can to actually counteract it, but you don't buy into it. You don't go into the fight or flight mechanism, which is based on the levels of conditioning that we could go into on a scientific level. But to be honest, I don't know about you, but I don't have the energy on a Sunday night, not at this moment in time, anyway. but you know, we could talk about it, and it's something that we have to, like I said earlier, we have to feel it for ourselves anyway. It's no point in somebody like myself coming on the radio and saying all these things unless somebody actually, they have to know it themselves, they have to feel it, and we can only be what we are as individuals, and from that point, we can only change the world from that, you know, from who we are. We can't go out and make a difference in the world by trying to fight and protest and all the other things. We can, if we want to, we can have that choice to do that. But we can also affect the world by sitting still and focusing on the things that really do count. And you know, that's not a cop out, by the way. That carries just as much weight as the banner wavers and all the rest of them that will probably no doubt take to the streets in the next few years because of the amount of injustices that are going to become so obvious to people as their eyes open and their hearts start to open. But you know, the other thing is, you open your mind and then you open your eyes and then, oh my God, what do you do? It's okay having an open mind. We can see through it all. It's a conspiracy, or we know what's going on in the world, and when we've worked it out, we're talking about these different levels of control that, you know, the likes of David has exposed and all the fantastic work that he's done over the years. And then we get to a point where we open our eyes and we see the true nature of life, and we see the reality for what it is, and how we actually create reality on an individual level. But then what do we do, Juliet? Then what do? We have to open our hearts, because they're the things that we have to remember. We have to literally remember what the heart is for.
There you go. Exactly.
We have to remember
exactly
why we have this heart and why we exist. And when we remember, then the world will change in that way, because there's nothing can prevent the outflowing from the heart back to infinite consciousness. And it's a two-way process. It's like a river going back to the ocean, backwards and forwards. It cannot be broken, that cycle. And once we remember it, and once we open all of our faculties in terms of perception, then that's when the world changes.
And I think the good news is that so many people are spontaneously waking up to that, you know.
Absolutely.
There's a tremendous quickening going on, and again, in spite of this encroaching darkness, and I think this, as David has been pointing out, bless him, they're afraid because they know, you know, there's really just a few of them, and there's so many of us, and as we are waking up and really moving back to the heart center, it's contagious, and it's just going to continue to grow and to grow and to grow. And again, as I think that we start to become, or to allow ourselves to return to our natural creative processes. However, you know, whatever medium or expression we choose to use, that is going to be very, very liberating for all of us and helping us to move into this higher plane where we really are free and we are going to break free of the shackles. And I still maintain, no matter what, that the light is going to prevail. It's got to prevail. When you switch on the light, the darkness dissipates straight away. It's gone.
So, like I said earlier, the two can't live in the same space.
Exactly.
You know, either have light or dark. And, you know, we're at the, I don't know about you or, you know, how maybe your listeners are reading this, but we're in this phase where, you know, the sun is rising. You know, we can see it. The light is starting to make its path across the, you know, across the sky. And it's going to reach momentum and, you know, by midday. Funnily enough, at midday, you know, in certain parts, shadows don't cast, do they? Because of the height of the sun, in that sense. And it's a wonderful analogy when you look at what it is. You can't have shadows when you have light at its full strength like that. So,
It's a tremendous source of inspiration for all of us. And I think that if we can remember, you know, to turn toward the light, you know, that's
right.
The whole idea
toward the light. What a great way to start to draw what we've been talking about to a close, eh? Toward the light. That's absolutely true, because I think that's where we have to turn. It does sound like we're coming across as, I mean, in some ways, you could, you know, listening to us, you know, we might think we're talking about almost an avoidance of what's going on but in the world, but we're not, because actually that's the only way out. There is this, you know, this ability to keep fighting at the same time, but on the same energy level or the same level of intellect, that will never change anything. You know, it's only going to change when we change our frequency, and our vibration
exactly.
changes with it. So I couldn't agree more with you, Julia. It's it's funny how this has gone this way, the conversation, because when I said I'd come on, I thought I'd be talking more about, you know, the art, but it's always happened with me. I always end up talking about something completely not disconnected, but, you know, slightly different to what I set out to talk about. I tend to make people fall asleep, especially the students. That, you know, I get digressing. It's, oh, Neil, not again. You know, he's going off on one. But, you know, it's, you just got to follow the flow, haven't you, really? You know, it's like going for a walk, isn't it? You know, sometimes you don't know where you're going to end up. So.
Well, it's like that John Lennon, like he says in that song, life happens whilst you're busy making other plans. And even, you know, so looking forward to Ike coming on, and then something happens. So it's, whoops, okay, so we got to do something else. And then also acknowledging at the same time everything is for a reason and everything is perfect and it's okay. And it really is for the good. And, I couldn't help but thinking that maybe dear David had a horrible allergic reaction to having been in Oxford, because it was just a few days ago, I believe, that he gave that lecture.
Yeah, I don't know.
And
that's
how blimey.
I was talking to him, bless him. It may well be that. It's a very strange place, I must admit, for anybody in the United States. But look, it's a very ancient place. I have another great friend who lives up that way, who's got some lovely books as well, which he doesn't get the publicity he deserves as well. A guy called Ellis Taylor, who has a website as well, along the same lines, I think it's his name, as the website, or Looking Into Dark Places, I think it is. And he has some wonderful books as well. And, you know, it's an interesting place. The whole area is, anyway. I mean, the UK is, as you know, Julia. You know, you know exactly from being over here as well. So, there's some very interesting places to visit. So,
it's very powerful in
the United Kingdom.
Yeah, very, very intense energy over there, and especially, I mean, that's kind of where all the ley lines converge too. And
absolutely, yeah. Well, I'm not far from Avebury, you know, the stone circles and all that.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm not far from there, so it's very, very, very lovely place.
Got to watch the people that are trying to, how do you call it, to corrupt those energies and turn them into something negative, but I really feel again that this is going to start to change soon. That's why I'm so grateful for, you know, the work that the lot of us are doing to really help bring some light and joy back into the world, because it really is there. it is there to be had. And that's what's so interesting about India is that the vast majority of them do experience such tremendous, not just joy, but utter bliss. And again, you can't hallucinate that kind of thing. It is really, it is the source of our being, actually. And that's why we're sent back to share this. I know you were talking about, that's an example of the work that David is doing, you know, sharing this information and walking that path. And many, many years ago, I had a friend who was, you know, I was teaching him a lot of things, and I said, well, I can walk beside you, but I can't walk for you. You've got to do your own walking. You've got to have your own experiences, and all I can do is set an example for you and share information with you, but then you've got to own it and make it your own. So this is the sort of work that we're doing, but I think also through the arts, through this work that we're doing in the art, we are really kind of through our osmosis imbuing people with this wonderful positive energy in the art.
Absolutely, Juliet. We're all each other at that level. So, you know, even the most humblest, the most simplest, the poorest, the meekest person who does, you know, the most act and round of kindness, of expression of creativity, like the story I told you at the beginning of the old man, the shepherd wanderer, who started planting trees that became huge forests, that attracted, vast attracted huge communities in the end, and they raised families on the land and farmland and all the rest of it. And the moral, the parable, or the reason for the story was that while he was doing that, other people were waging war.
Yes.
They were using their creativity to fight each other, to express themselves in a way that would negate and would keep them locked into this shadow vibration we were talking about. One random act of kindness by one simple person as such, or by one extraordinary but ordinary at the same time human being, is all it needs. It doesn't need to be, one pebble thrown in the river creates ripples. And those ripples carry on. And they affect.
There's a powerful message in that too, Neil, because when people experience their life reviews during the near-death state, what is really particularly noted and acknowledged are the little acts of kindness, not the great feats of accomplishment. But little acts of kindness, and so this is really monumental for people to understand and to know that just doing something very kind and helpful for another person, or even for an animal or another creature or in nature, what have you, that is what is noticed. That is what is noticed. That is what is important, because when you instinctively just want to do something kind and loving towards another living being, that is
absolutely wonderful. And you know what that is? That is a complete and utter expression and understanding of what oneness is about.
Because
as the teachings say in that way, if I think it, again, I'm going back to the teachings of Jesus as such, and the idea of expressing oneness in a simplistic way that people could understand at that time, and it literally is. When I was ill, you comforted me. You know, when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was naked, you clothed me. You know, when I was in prison, you visited me. All of these things you have done. And then the whole idea of, but you say, when have you done those things for me? And the answer was, he who does that to the least of my brethren, they do it to me also.
Yeah.
And it's the expression of oneness through humility, through kindness, through mercy. It's through those, for me anyway, it's my own view, it's through those acts of kindness that is an expression of infinite love. It's not through debating it or trying to analyze it or to, you know, even necessarily to be kind of, you know, almost a sort of, trying to sort of define it in that way. But the only way we can define it is through our own acts of kindness, and obviously through how we do that, through creativity, generally through love, through empathy, through compassion. All those things are you know, are what really what we are at our core. It's what I feel anyway. You know, obviously some would say, actually, no, we're by nature we're a little bit evil. You hear people say that, you know, oh, we're animals really. You know, we're you know, you do you know what I'm saying, Juliet? You hear people say that, and on one level that is true, but that's only the outer surface. That's only the it's only the controls, isn't it? It's whoever's driving the car. It's the consciousness that's driving the vehicle that is that happens to have a similar DNA structure to the animal that it came from or was connected to. It's got nothing to do with the consciousness that gets inside the vehicle and illuminates it and empowers it.
Well, that's exactly it. That's why I really like to make that point too. Again, getting back to consciousness, it doesn't come from the brain. And as David so rightly points out, and I've got to thank him a squillion times because he points out, well, there's the body computer and there's the brain that's the CPU, but it's still got to have an operator. And I thought, thank you, spot on there, friend, you know, because the operator is infinite consciousness and that's not the brain. It is. You know, it's so much grander than that. And the more people can really start to grok that, as it were, then we are going to be able to eliminate the fear of death, because really and truly there is no such thing. There's only change. But there's never death. We just grow and evolve and change.
The American Indians call it dropping of the cloak or something. It was.
Yes, and that's really what it is. They're so wise, those beings. In fact, I was doing a lot of study, actually, of Native American near-death experiences. And then when I was in the choir in Nashville, we actually did a song, a Native American song, called All Things Are Connected.
Oh, well, there you
Bingo.
Go.
That's really spot on.
Yeah, it is.
God love you, lad. You know, we've been acting for 2 hours, and this is so wonderful. Oh, yeah. We're just being told we got to sign off now because we've come to the end of this wonderful transmission of Toward the Light.
Yeah.